This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Lisa Falk, artist and head of community engagement at the Arizona State Museum. Lisa, the Arizona State Museum is the oldest and largest anthropological research museum in the Southwest, established in 1893. Wow, that blew me away.
Well, there, in 1893, the museum was established as the Territorial Museum by Governor George P. Hunt. And when Arizona became a state in 1912, the museum became the Arizona State Museum. So the museum's collections include archaeological, which was its foundation, ethnographic, and modern objects and artworks created by the indigenous people of the U.S. Southwest and Northwest Mexico. And three of our collections, this is a great honor, the Fiber Arts and Basketry Collection, the Pottery Collection, and our Photography Collections have been designated national treasures by a federal agency, the National Endowment for the Arts, in conjunction with, I believe it's the National Park Service. And Arizona State Museum is also the official archaeological repository for the state of Arizona.
So what were the values of the governor and or of the government in that decision that it was important to have a state museum?
It's part of being considered a state. You have a you have a museum, you have a penitentiary, and you have a university.
The museum has definitely had to pivot along with everybody else during COVID-19, right? Could you talk to us a little bit about the programming that's being offered now and here at the end of the year?
Currently the museum's closed because of COVID-19, so we've been focusing on online programming, and ASM is an affiliate of the Smithsonian, so we've partnered with the Smithsonian to offer a lecture each month, and last month's was fascinating. It was about the Green Book, a book that allowed Black travelers to know where they are welcome to eat or sleep. And I looked up Arizona's entries, and we have quite a few, actually, such as the Copper Hotel in Bisbee and La Posada in Winslow. And the Green Book really made it possible, you know, for Black people to travel safely in a world that wasn't safe and maybe isn't today. So they haven't a traveling exhibit. Unfortunately, it's not coming to Arizona, but we got to present the lecture and along with 20 other Smithsonian affiliates. And then the one next week that we're presenting from them is a roundtable discussion of Smithsonian specialists sharing stories about collecting objects and documents from presidential campaigns for the nation's collection and what messages the objects and campaigns convey about their times. We've also been offering online classes, you know, 4-part classes with some of our faculty members from the State Museum. And then I've been in charge of a talk series. It's an 8-part series called Border Barriers, History, and Impact. That relates to an exhibit we currently have up that nobody can see, a traveling exhibit. And we're 2/3 of the way through. We have over 600 people signed up for the series with about 250 people coming to each session. And then next month, on November 10th and 17th, we're turning to how people have interpreted the border through the arts. So we're looking at music such as corridos and documentary photography and fiction. We have a picture book writer, we have an adult writer, and a sort of young adult writer. It's been a little harder to pivot our youth program. We had planned a whole long day-long program looking at the border from the voices of from preschool on up to college students, and had a lot of interactivity planned on our lawn and special pop-up exhibits. And all that's a little harder to transition online. And so I'm working with Marge Pellegrino, a local writer and teacher here who's just amazing. And she and I are going to teach a special class for probably two high schools of teachers who've been participating in our border lecture series. And we'll work with the students to help them explore borders through creative writing. But in addition, we're preparing for reopening and, you know, exploring what does that mean to reopen in a safe way for the community? What precautions we need to take in to make sure everybody's safe with sanitizing stations and a plexiglass at the lobby desk and wayfaring signs to help people. Hopefully in early February, we will be opening up a new exhibit called Wrapped in Color, Legacies of the Mexican Serape, which we've been working on for the last year with a Zapotec weaver, Porfirio Gutierrez, as one of the co-curators with myself and with Andrew Higgins, who's our registrar and a specialist in our ethnographic collections. And so it's going to be a beautiful, colorful exhibit because the exhibit not only shows historic textiles and the contemporary interpretations that Porfirio's been doing, very high art, but also tells the story of the spread of the style and its influence, but also how natural dyeing is part of Zapotec culture. It goes back thousands of years, and the colors of indigo and cochineal, which we have on our nopals here. When you see that white stuff on the nopal pads, have you ever seen that? Well, those are the cochineal bugs, and if you squeeze them, they create a bright red. And back for many, many, thousands of years, indigenous people in Central America cultivated cochineal to get the red to dye their wools. And when the Spanish came, they didn't have red easily in Europe, and it was a royal color because of that. They took over the cultivation fields and transported that dye back to the old world. And that was pretty much how you got red until aniline dyes came in the 1880s.
COVID-19 obviously has hit museums pretty hard, and we just talked about what the Arizona State Museum has kind of done to pivot. But it just at large, what do you think about the future of museums in the United States? What kinds of conversations are museums having right now?
A lot. I've been to more webinars than I ever have. It's been a hard year for museums, and it's going to continue to be hard for the next several years until the economy lifts itself back up, until we have a vaccine and people feel safe going out. ASM, like many, many museums, has laid off a lot of staff, and we aren't filling positions of people who have or are retiring this year. And all staff have had a pay cut with the equivalent of furlough days, which makes it hard since our workloads have increased as well. But museums overall are resilient. They're full of creative, passionate staff who work hard to continue to protect collections and serve their communities. And many of us have taken our programs and exhibits online. Some are serving as voting centers or welcoming schools to use them as a school site, but we're all struggling. Many that have been hit the hardest are the education programs, the front-end staff. And so I hope people, as they're doing their year-end donating, I know we've all been giving to political campaigns, but I hope people will think about their local museums, because that's their community. And we can't exist without the support of the community. And all of us have taken a hit across the country in revenue from admissions, but also from programming and other things. And we need to start raising money to bring back our educators and our front-end staff. And I guess one of the good things from COVID is that it doesn't matter where you are to attend a museum program. So I attended one in Ohio the other day at another museum. I've been going to some at the Fowler Museum in LA. We have people from Canada and other states, of course, at our lecture series. I did some teacher workshops online this summer, and there were people from India and Cairo and Mexico at them. So that is one of the good things about going online, is that our communities have expanded. But as we think of our physical institutions as places and centers where community can come together, we all need your support now.
Lisa, we talked previously about Arizona State Museum's process for getting community feedback, speaking of community, on exhibit concepts from the conceptual point forward, and also getting engagement on, for example, museum community days. Could you tell us a little bit about how that works and what your process is for consulting with the community?
Through the Eyes of the Eagle, Illustrating Healthy Living was one in 2011. And then, well, another one I guess I should mention, Photo ID, Portraits by Native Youth, and it had to do with an exhibit we had about Curtis, Edward S. Curtis's photographs, and that was in 2014. And then last fall, it seems like it was more than a year ago now, but it was Sorting Out Race, Examining Racial Identity Through Thrift Store Donations, Racial Identity and Stereotypes Through Thrift Store Donations. And then, as I mentioned before, we currently have A History of Walls and the Borders We Build. And for all of these, when an idea comes up, first of all, we we vet it through the museum, but I also often vet it in other places, whether it's with university colleagues or with community members, because we're part of the university community as the State Museum as well. So there's two communities, the university one and the Greater Tucson community. And if you now go COVID, the rest of the world, right? So like with the Through the Eyes of the Eagle one, which was an exhibit of children's books, and it was the artwork from a series of books that the CDC had produced, the Center for Disease Controls had produced about diabetes awareness aimed at Native communities with the idea of reaching young children. They were picture books. I took the books to the Native Education Alliance, which is an informal group of mainly Native educators and a few other educators like myself who work with Native materials or Native populations. And I said, should we do this exhibit? What did they think? I wanted some feedback, and they were very enthusiastic about it and said they'd help me with community planning around it. Because when I initially took it to the museum, they just thought it was a book of picture, an exhibit of picture books, and they didn't see the importance at first. They later did, but at first. And so I said I wanted to work with the community to make it meaningful. Once I had that sort of okay from my colleagues who were Native. Together, we held a community planning meeting. We all invited anybody and everyone we could think of that had anything to do with nutrition, food ways, being active, physically active, children's writing, artwork, Native artwork, anything remotely related to what this exhibit topic is. We had about 30 people show up, Native and non-Native, to the exhibit. Some were university people. Most of them were community people. And we showed them, I projected the book and showed it to them. It's actually a series of four books, and said, how can we make this relevant, engaging, and meaningful to our community? And it's a very important in all communities across the state. Diabetes is on the rise, but particularly in Native communities. For example, in the Tonantin Nation, over 50% of the people have diabetes, which means that affects everybody, all families. You know, in the Hispanic community, I don't know what the current number is, but I think it was about 38% or 26% for the African-American community. And I think the Anglo community is similar. I mean, it's just really high amounts. We had many, many ideas, which I was amazed at the end of the run of the exhibit. I went back through that initial list and checked them all off. We had done all of them. It was amazing. Some of the partners for this was, as I mentioned, the Native Education Alliance, the Tucson Indian Center, Tonantin Community Action, Ashan Preparatory and Leadership School, Pima County Health Department, American Diabetes Association. At the UA, it was the College of Public Health, the World of Worlds Library, which is part of the College of Ed, the College of Agriculture. We got some support from Raytheon employee groups. The Pima County Public Library worked with us, and the UA Student Health Advisory Council. So we ended up expanding it beyond just the artwork. The ideas that came out of, they wanted us to expand and tell a local story. So we invited Tonantin Community Action, which is also called TOCA, and Terrell Dew Johnson, who is the CEO of it, to tell whatever story they wanted to. We gave them a third of the exhibit space. We said, what do you want to do? And we'll make it happen. And we worked with some youth in their youth program to make it happen. And they created a timeline of all the work they'd been doing to farm and bring back indigenous foods into the schools, but also working with people on traditional arts. And the students figured out how they wanted to show it. They had cases showing then and now of food ways and exercise or games. We added three cases to the exhibit. One was a timeline of the food ways of the Sonoran Desert for 13,000 years. And that was then punctuated with objects from our collection and photographs of, for example, of game animals, which I got from the Desert Museum. So another partner there. We also had a third case. That one had eight skateboards in it because skateboarding is big in Indian country. It's you're physical. You have a group that you hang with when you have to be together to be able to keep your balance on a skateboard. I mean, I'm not very good at it, but you can't be out of it to skateboard. You know, you have to be together and it's physical and it's engaging. So we worked with different artists and had eight skateboards, six which became permanent parts of the Arizona State Museum collection after the exhibit. When you're going to do this, somebody has to, you know, take the responsibility. So it was up to me to find the funds to do all this and to make sure everybody could communicate together and the pieces could happen. We ended up also even making a comic book. We had funding from the Arts Foundation, back then it was called the Tucson Pima Arts Foundation, under one of their Sense of Place grants. It was very early. This was 2011, so it was our first app. And it was a comic book app as well as a website version of this comic book. And then Pima County Health Department loved it so much, they printed 5,000 copies of it for us. And you can still see that comic book. It's on our website under online exhibits. It's called It's Up to You with the number 2. And that was also collaborative. I worked with Ryan Hunnis-Smith. He was the artist, and he and I wrote it together. And then we worked with various youth to come up with names for things and to test out ideas. We worked with a group of Hispanic youth, a group of Native youth, a mixed group, and to find out what do they know about diabetes, in particular type 2 diabetes, and what kind of comic stories do they like, and what do they like? And it was interesting because at the end of our sessions, we had them fill out a little comic strip about something healthy. And over the story would come back that the kid fell asleep and had a dream, and in the dream, he would like ran a race and won it and won the girl type of thing. Right. And so we were like, and then they told us, the kids told us they wanted the horrors of diabetes. But we also planned a community health fair. And I remember I was a different director back then, but I brought my grant proposal to her to sign. She said, and now you're doing a health fair? And I just stood there very strong and said, yes, that's what the community told me they wanted. I don't remember now, but I think we had like around 800 people show up. We worked with the College of Ag, and we had cooking demonstrations going on from one of their chefs that does the garden, started the garden kitchen, as well as from Native chefs showing different healthy food ways. We had a little farmer's market. We worked with Parks and Rec, and we had sack bag races. We had UA athletes doing clinics on tennis and different things. But we also had a whole lot of people doing performances. We wanted to show people you don't have to leave your culture to be healthy. So we had autumn dancers, we had Barbia Williams there, among others. We had storytellers, we had folklorico dance. We also brought in a group from San Carlos Apache of skateboarders to do skateboarding demo as well. And the College of Ag also had you roping steers, all kinds of things. So it was really great. And, you know, we did audience evaluation with it. And the majority of the people, I'd say about 80% of the people expressed that the exhibits and programs made them think about and inspired them to focus more on being active, eating healthy, and making others aware of how to live a more healthy lifestyle.
Do you have any advice for anybody who wants to engage in a big collaboration? Like how, any advice in terms of communicating, keeping organized? How could you help them along?
Well, I think first being open to whatever ideas off the wall or not that people have. And going with the flow, not going into something with preconceived ideas. But, you know, presenting, this is the opportunity. What do you all think? What can we do to make it meaningful? From your perspective, what should we be doing with this? What do you want to do with this, if anything? And I know, you know, when we were sitting around the table and people were saying, you know, most of the material about diabetes is aimed at little kids, including these books. They were elementary school, lower end, well, picture books, you know, they're aimed at second grade, maybe. First grade, I don't know. And they said, you know, but the kids are controlled by their parents at that point. But when they get to middle school, it's full, you know, they can do whatever they want. And that's where it falls apart sometimes, middle and high school. You know, I turned to Ryan, who was sitting next to me, and he was there as an educator from Hashan Preparatory and Leadership School, but I knew he was also an artist. And his art style is very much got a lot of sort of manga influences, the comic book influences. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but the comic book influence in his work and his aesthetic. And I talked to him quietly and I said, what do you think about doing a comic book? Do you think that has any merit? Would you want to do it with me? And we chatted and he said yes. And so then I turned to the whole table and I said, hey, Ryan and I have an idea. What do you guys think about it? And I presented it to him. Everybody loved it. And at that point, it was right when there was a lot going on in our community at that time. Tucson Pima Arts Council had a grant, a Sense of Place grant, that used arts to deal with community issues. And so we applied to them, and they loved the idea and gave us funding. But that comic book ended up driving some of our other funding as well. They said, you know, really the use of a comic book to reach a particular audience, and we were making a digital comic book, was what drove them giving us much, a lot of funding, more than just for the comic book, that helped us hire staff and do all that we were doing. So really, it sometimes the ideas that are you don't even know you're going to have come up at these community meetings. So I said, be open to that, but then also take responsibility. I knew it was up to me to be the project manager. I knew it was up to me to find the funding to make these ideas happen. I didn't expect my community partners to give us anything. They ended up providing all kinds of services, but I never asked them, would you give me funding? Would you take responsibility for making this happen? I took that responsibility. And then we work together on how it was going to happen. So I think that's really important as well. I think communicate. I sent emails to everybody. You know, I had lunch meetings and coffee meetings and talked to people. People couldn't come to a big meeting, which we didn't have many after the initial few, but I would meet with them in smaller meetings. You have to maintain the communications, and not just during your project. You've built relationships now, so you keep them afterwards. And they provide opportunities. So then when we had the Curtis exhibit of photos, I turned to Hashan and I just called him up and said, hey, we're having this exhibit of Edward S. Curtis's photos. Would anybody want to work on a project with me there? I just called the woman at the front desk who I knew very well. And she said, oh, you need to talk to Coletta Saddleback. She's our art teacher. So I invited Coletta to the museum to see it. And it went from there. We ended up doing an exhibit together, you know, program in the classroom and an exhibit. So those relationships keep happening. If you take care of them.
Lisa, you had mentioned a traveling exhibit that the museum hosted about a year ago, the Sorting Out Race exhibit, which today feels perhaps even more relevant than just a year ago in terms of the national movement around structural racism that we're more deeply engaged in. Could you describe the exhibit and some of its enhancements?
The exhibit is called Sorting Out Race, Examining Racial Identity and Stereotypes Through Thrift Store Donations. It was created by the Kauffman Museum at Bethlehem College in Kansas. And they created it because one of their thrift stores in the community had been pulling things from their shelves, so not putting them out, that she found offensive. Mm-hmm. And she came to the museum and said, would you guys want this stuff? And they looked at it, and then, you know, in brainstorming with other thrift stores and with their colleagues, they decided we're going to make an exhibit about this stuff because it's a reflection of our lifeways. It's a reflection of our community, right? What you find in thrift stores. And so they created this exhibit using the donated thrift store objects. When I'm in charge of our exhibits and our programming, though many people at the museum do programming, I always think of them together, not separate. How can they work to get people to come in and see the exhibit, but also how does the exhibit become inspiration for creative programming? And when you walked into the exhibit, it was like you walked to the first thing you were confronted with was what looked like the facade, a window in any typical thrift store. There was even a door that you should walk through to go into the thrift store. And some of the objects that were in the window sported stereotypes and others didn't. But think about the stuff you find in thrift stores. It's items that people have donated, usually when someone moves or somebody dies. It's old stuff. Right. So there is a little time lapse there in what you see in a thrift store. Sometimes it's newer, but often it's older. And many of those older items had stereotypical images. So in the window, some of the things that you could see on display included Chinese checkers with a Chinese man in a typical Chinese costume from a century ago. Way of dress from a century ago, hairstyle from then, not from today. There were, and I say it in quotes, cute smiling Indians with Thanksgiving motifs. There are black toys, dolls that look like stereotypes of domestic workers on plantations. So those are some of the stereotypical things in there. There were the covers on some of the movies, the Disney movies, you know, on VHS tapes. As well, and some books. So things that, you know, you just don't even notice usually, yet they're there. And if you're trained to look, you do notice them, and they're very offensive. The exhibit had various sections, including on what is race, and what are stereotypes, how do you recognize racism, and also how people are reclaiming stereotypes today. So there was one section that supported some of the research of Maribel Alvarez, who is a professor here at the University of Arizona and the head of Tucson Meet Yourself. Maribel has a collection of what are often called the sleeping Mexican, where it's a man wearing a sombrero. He's sitting down, often with his back to a saguaro cactus, which none of us living in the desert would do, right? But he's taking a siesta in the whatever shade he can find. And as Maribel explained, those are hardworking people that you're seeing represented here. They're farm workers. They're up before dawn. They work in the fields. They have their lunch. They take a rest during the very hottest part of the day, seeking any shade. And then they go back into the fields. So it's not a statement of a lazy, drunk, stereotypical image. It is a statement of a hardworking person. And so that's what she's talking about when she says reclaiming stereotypes. And they had other examples like that. There was a space in the exhibit where you could design a new logo for a football team. Maybe the Washington football team needs some help. So, but we added, you asked about how we embellished it. We added several things to the exhibit. We wanted to place the story in our region too. Where we live and help people reflect. So we added a section on the Spanish caste system. Do you know what that is?
Yes, absolutely. It's the very hierarchical racial system that the Spanish used to categorize people when they came to the Americas and started mixing with the indigenous groups.
Exactly. It was a way to keep people in their place and to let wealthy Spanish people have control over money and social situations. With it comes a lot of bias that is driven down through the centuries, even if the system is no longer in place. So we reproduced a painting, a caste system painting that depicted, you know, if a Spaniard marries an Indian, then he's called, their child is this. If that child marries a Spaniard, then their child is this. If a Spaniard marries an African, it had another name. So we put up that, and Michael Brescia, who is a historian on our staff, wrote some background information about that. So we wanted to, you know, show what's the history of racism and stereotypes in our community. I mean, this was New Spain, so that's what I mean about our community, the larger expanse here. But we also added a film by Paul Chat Smith. The film is called The Invention of Thanksgiving, and it talks about the myths around people's thoughts about Thanksgiving. And I re-looked at the film last night. You can look at it. It's on the National Museum of American Indians website. It's part of an online exhibit called The Americans, which I highly recommend. He states, Thanksgiving is about trying to come to terms with this very difficult truth about the United States, that the country is a national project that came about at great expense to Native people. And he goes on to say that we like the story of pilgrims and Indians coming together and wanting the U.S. to seem neighborly, to seem good. And he states, but we know it didn't all work out. But that's what we aspire to be as Americans. The other thing, and we had this, one of these also, we had a talk back area in the diabetes, the Illustrating Healthy Living exhibit. And we put it in many of exhibits. We add reflection areas. And we have one in the walls exhibit as well. And in this one, in the Sorting Out Race exhibit, we asked three questions. We asked, if you've been stereotyped, share your story and how you reacted. We wanted people to be able to share that and also to show examples of how did they overcome it? What was the reaction to it? And there were a lot of stories. It was overflowing, the area there. Another thing we asked is, before seeing this exhibit, I didn't realize. And I pulled out some of the answers from our survey, from the cards. People posted these in cards. And so some of them included, before seeing this exhibit, I didn't realize how trinkets convey stereotypes based on misunderstood cultural practices. I didn't realize how deeply embedded discrimination and racism in particular are in our society. I didn't realize how many everyday objects, including some Disney movies, carry a racist connotation and how many objects I simply glazed over without thinking about its context. I didn't realize what looks funny, fine, just a costume, just a toy, school sports, spirit, adorable, sexy, a game, a joke, to you, your friends, or your family member. It's insulting to someone else. And these are direct quotes from the cards. The other thing we asked is, we wanted people to walk out again feeling empowered. what was an action that would result from seeing this exhibit? So we asked, as a result of seeing this exhibit, I will, and some of those answers are, be more intentional about identifying the symbolism, context of everyday objects and choices. I will continue to work to be aware of racism that is soaked into me from a lifetime of living in our culture. Where it's in the air we breathe, the things we see and hear, our entertainment, etc. When I'm aware of racist thoughts that arise in my mind, I have the chance to question them and to choose not to allow them to drive my behavior. This is how change begins. But I'll add one more comment, and I think it's something to think about. It says, keep an eye out for other exhibits that discuss issues of people of color but are clearly made for white people.
It's a lot to think about, and how these exhibits are created. Those are really great questions, right? Somebody who has been traumatized by structural racism is probably going to have a very different experience of that type of an exhibit than, you know, perhaps a white person who is just kind of waking up to the reality of structural racism and how people around them are affected by it. So for one, it's more of a, you know, maybe a new learning experience. And for another type of person, it might actually be kind of terribly familiar. So those are really excellent points. Thank you for bringing
that
up.
They came from the community of visitors, right?
Lisa, I have just one last question. There is a lot of diversity among the indigenous people who make up and have made up Arizona and the surroundings. How can we learn more about the diversity of the native peoples who are from this area?
Sure. I'd say first know the people whose homelands you're living, working, and walking on. So ASM is on the ancestral lands of the Tanaatam. It's also the homelands of Pasco Yaqui. Know the tribes that are currently living in your state. In Arizona, there are 22 tribes. In the United States, there are 574 federally recognized tribes at the moment. It fluctuates. That's a whole other story. And there are others who are not recognized, such as the many tribal communities in California. I'd say visit museums such as the Arizona State Museum, the Heard Museum, the Museum of Northern Arizona. If you can get to D.C., the Smithsonian's National Museum of American Indian, and tribal museums. Here in locally, we have the Himdaki Cultural Center Museum at Tanaatam out in Topala near Sells, the Huahugam Heritage Center at Hill River. Look at tribal websites. Read Indian Country Today. Listen to Native American Calling. I mean, expose yourself to other avenues to learn about Native American history, not just what you heard in school. And a good overview book I'd recommend is The Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. There's, I think that's the sort of middle school version of it, but there's an adult one too. And ASM's book, Path of Life, that relates to our permanent exhibit. The Smithsonian's book, Do All Indians Live in Teepees? Questions and Answers from the National Museum of the American Indian, are all great resources to start with.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, Lisa.
Thank you. It's kind of fun to go back over all these cool projects I got the privilege to work on. Great gratitude to the community for allowing me to work with them.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. Support for Artist Stories is provided by Benjamin Supply, presenting a full spectrum of hardware and plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath, and their gallery, Tucson, offering national and local art in both the Tucson Warehouse and Transfer Buildings on 6th Street and 7th Avenue. With products available at will call, they are currently open by phone at 777-7000 and at benjaminsupply.com or gallerytucson.com.